Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, why your political identity is influencing a lot more than who you vote for. But first, it will be about a year before voters start to winnow the field of would-be Democratic nominees, and it is shaping up to be a big field. As candidates announce their intentions to run for president, we're returning to our segment, What Does That Democrat Bring to the Party? And by party, I mean the primary party and the Democratic Party as a whole. Last week, we talked about Elizabeth Warren. Today, we're talking about Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, and Kirsten Gillibrand, three Democrats who have said they're seeking the Democratic nomination. We're turning to Natasha Kurecki. She's national correspondent for Politico, and she's with us today from Chicago. Natasha, welcome. And thank you for being game to take on all of these candidates and chat with me about it. I appreciate it.
We're at the point where we already have to do three at a time. Huh?
Already? I know. I just started. I'm starting with Senator Gillibrand because this is really a remarkable
right.
field that's developing here and so many women running for president. Here's my question for you. Is this an intersection of women's empowerment, the Trump presidency, hashtag Me Too, and what else? What's going on here with all these women getting in?
Well, right. No, I think you nailed it on the head. And the other component would be you look at the midterm elections and the success of diversity and women in particular in, you know, in all the House races, taking back the House. You have Nancy Pelosi. So it's really the, you know, they think it's the year of the woman. It's the era of the woman. There's you know, it's just proof in the pudding. There was success already. And then certainly some of the other points you just tacked off with Gillibrand, she has really butted heads with Trump. She, if you look at some of the, you know, there's different ratings of who's voted the most and the least. You know, she's one of the ones who's really shown herself apart from Trump. She's also came out as a mother, you know, when she announced on The Late Show that she was doing a presidential bid. She did it from that standpoint and, you know, very much put that front and center. It's those different intersections that are making her kind of a pretty interesting candidate at this point.
My guess is that there are voters and listeners in our neck of the woods here, upper Midwest, who started to notice her when she played a key role in Senator Franken's decision ultimately to resign. I want to play something that she said at the time as Senator Franken was making this decision.
Enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time, and it's a conversation that this country needs to have. And I think when we start having to talk about the differences between sexual assault and sexual harassment and unwanted groping, you are having the wrong conversation. You need to draw a line in the sand and say none of it is okay. None of it is acceptable. And we, as elected leaders, should absolutely be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard. And we should fundamentally be valuing women.
You know, Natasha, what it seems like to me in retrospect, because we talked about it and covered it, is that once she said that, it became kind of impossible for Senator Franken to continue. What's your memory of this?
Well, you know, actually, I've written about this quite a bit, and there's been sort of a backlash against Gillibrand because of that. Not so much so that I think, you know, the average voter really that it resonates with them, but certainly among the donor class, the political class, you know, Washington, D.C., it was seen as, you know, if you want to put the most critical eye on it as some kind of power grab. You know, there's a lot of people in the donor class who thought she was just trying to position herself and without giving him due process, without giving Senator Franken due process. You know, of course, she says something very different. We just heard you know, what her take was on that at the time. But it is something that rubbed a lot of Democrats, powerful Democrats, the wrong way. You had some, you know, George Soros on down, big donors saying we will never give her money because of that move.
Yeah.
So it was very controversial. Now, if you try selling that to an average voter, if they hear that, it's a difficult thing for another Democrat to attack her on if you're on the debate stage. Or even, you know, in the run-up in the campaign, because it seems counterintuitive. Wait, she held someone responsible for sexual harassment at that time.
So it's
an interesting, a very interesting dynamic, and I'm certain that, you know, people in Minnesota know it much more and followed it much more closely than people elsewhere in the country.
Hey, I also want to talk to you about Tulsi Gabbard, but with the caveat that I don't know if her candidacy is really going anywhere. She told Van Jones on CNN that she intends to run, and then the digging began into her record, and it was quickly learned that she said nice things about the concept of gay conversion therapy in 2004 as a state legislator. She led the charge against a bill that would have prevented, again, so this bill would have legalized civil unions in Hawaii, and she was opposed to it and one of the leaders against it. What's happening with her candidacy? Do you know?
Well, you're right. She is under an intense microscope, and you know this happens a lot with, you know, before people announce there's opposition research dumps trying to keep somebody from actually getting in and so forth. But yeah, anytime you step into the spotlight, your record's going to come forward. And she did have a stance that was seen as very hostile to the LGBTQ community. And it's coming back to haunt her very quickly. In this kind of field, in a primary, it could be a very difficult position for her. I mean, she's since, you know, made strides. She's talked about how she's emerged, or how she's evolved, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's other questions that people raise, even about, you know, is she an apologist for Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad? You know, is she too much of a hawk on terrorism? That type of thing. But, you know, she'll have to contend with if she's on the trail.
You said something interesting a minute ago, and we've been doing this when we do these, when I think about these segments, is talking about biography more than how does she compare to the others. She has, as does Kirsten Gillibrand, as you've said, the way she will position herself as appealing to suburbans. She's a mother herself. She's a defender of, you know, women and women's rights and empowerment. Tulsi Gabbard, I mean, comes to this with, she's an Iraq war veteran. She's the first Hindu person elected to Congress, co-founder of the Future Caucus in Congress. I thought that was pretty interesting. I mean, she's one of these where if you can break through with your biography, it seems like her biography could be interesting to voters. What would you say?
Right. It's certainly unusual. It definitely stands out. She's done a lot of things that stand out and would break her apart from other candidates. And I'll also add to what you just said. She's done the work in early states. She's been in Iowa numerous times, including late last year. Her name is well known there. In New Hampshire, she was there the last week of December. Her name's also, you know, getting out there, at least among, you know, sort of the activist class and you know, some of the key stakeholders in both of those states. So she's definitely done more than just go on CNN and announce. She's gone to these states, met with different groups. I talked to the Black Caucus in Iowa, who met with her,
mm-hmm.
And that was back in October.
Wow.
So she's been doing something. She's definitely been doing more than, you know, just a tacit exploration.
I think Julian Castro is interesting. Seen as a rising star, there was a lot of talk that Hillary Clinton was considering him to run as her vice presidential candidate, and this experience as housing secretary. I mean, housing is, you know this in Chicago, we know it here in the Twin Cities. Housing is one of those issues that you don't hear a lot of problem solving at the federal level on, but he will speak with a lot of credibility on this issue. Does that give him you know, a place, a way to set himself apart, again, biography, experience, knowledge from this field. Will it be important, do you think?
Right. No, absolutely. That gives him, you know, a central issue that he, like you said, has a lot of credibility on. Don't forget, of course, Obama, part of the Obama coalition. He'll use that as much as he can. And what really sets him apart is he's the first major Latino candidate. Mm. When he gave his announcement, he did part of it in Spanish. He's very open about his Mexican-American heritage. He had his mom there when he spoke to the crowd. Having a well-known name in Texas is helpful, and in Nevada, another early state where he could have a path going through an early state where there's a large Latino population.
Here's Julian Castro making his announcement, as Natasha says, with his family around him and speaking to this idea of how key immigration is to his own personal story.
When my grandmother got here almost 100 years ago, I'm sure that she never could have imagined that just two generations later, one of her grandsons would be serving as a member of the United States Congress, and the other would be standing with you here today to say these words: I am a candidate for President of the United States of America.
Julian Castro there announcing his bid for the Democratic nomination. Natasha, I was reading one of your colleagues, Bill Scherr's, story about Castro in Politico, and he wrote, at some point, he and his fellow second and third tier candidates will need to stand for something significant and do it in a way that no one else in the field is willing to do if they want their presidential adventure to be remembered as more than a punchline or the end of a once promising career. Bill takes no prisoners, does he?
No.
What do you think? Do you agree with that?
Certainly, I think it's too early to say. I mean, think about every presidential election we've all been through. You know, think about 2016 when everyone early on said, oh my gosh, Scott Walker, he's the front runner. And how quickly that played out.
That's right.
You just don't know at the beginning. There are certainly, when you talked to Elizabeth Warren last week, there's certainly candidates like that who seem built to last at least longer because they put so many good people around them. But you just don't know in these times who's going to catch fire. It's no longer you're reliant on, you know, super PACs. A lot of them are turning away from super PACs.
Right.
You're looking at small donors. So you don't know who's going to get propped up, who's going to catch fire and ride a wave. And, you know, it just could be, you know, this changing discussion right now, and someone you never expected could end up rising to the top.
I was listening to a podcast yesterday about Beto O'Rourke. What do you have any kind of a gut feel about what he will do? He is getting a lot of encouragement.
He's getting a lot of encouragement. I think he ultimately, you know, if he has any interest in all at all, why not dip your toe into it? Heck, everyone else is, but certainly, there's enough people telling him right now that this is his moment. He's on, you know, here he is, relative newcomer to the national stage. I mean, ever since the, you know, Ted Cruz challenge, and you know, he's early polls. Yes, they ultimately might mean nothing, but at least right now, his name recognition is really high. He's ranking in top three nationally, right after Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Not too shabby. So I think it would be, I would not at all be surprised if he ends up running. Is he going to take too long? Is he waiting too long to get to some of these early states? I mean, that's another question. Will it have passed him by? I don't know. I mean, when you talk to people out on the street and, you know, just regular voters, it seems like there is this curiosity. Not, you know, they're not already in love with him because there's a huge field, but there is a curiosity about Beto. They want to hear more from him and about him.
It's going to be exciting, isn't it, Natasha, to cover this?
Yeah, it really is. It's going to change a lot, I think.
Come back and talk.
Over the next, few months.
Come back and talk again, and thanks much. Good to have you.
I love that. Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.